Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the new podcast where we invite members of the historical community to get angry, to get a few things off their chest. My name is Paul Bavel and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Kyle Glover.
Hello.
And this week's guest is here to talk about the deep, dark world of counter-invasion. This week, we have Second World War historian and press officer for the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Team, Andy Chatterton. Hello, Andy.
Hello there, how are you?
Oh, very well. How are you, sir?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
Excellent. Well, before we dive in on what annoys the hell out of you, let's just ask a little bit about the sort of stuff that you do actually like. Tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and the work that you do.
Yeah, so I, outside of my day job, am, as you said, the press officer for the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Team, which are a group of volunteer researchers who look into the auxiliary units and special duties branch and various other aspects of as you said, civilian anti-invasion groups that were set up during the early part of the Second World War, all of which were highly secret, most of whom went to the grave without telling anyone what they got up to, including family and friends, but are just the most remarkable people who we believe at CART deserve so much more public recognition and official recognition than they ever got. They didn't even get the Defence Medal, for example, that the Home Guard got. So I help promote what we find, show pictures of secret underground bunkers. It's all very exciting, a lot more interesting than my day job. And yeah, we just help research and try and find out as much as we can about these guys in order to boost the recognition in the public, which I think we've been doing generally a good job over the last few years, at least. I think the recognition has gone up, but there's lots more to do on that point, and there's loads more out there that we're still finding about every day. There's still relatives coming forward. We're still informing relatives that their granddad or their dad wasn't actually just a Home Guard, but actually a highly trained guerrilla warfare and sabotage and silent killer. So yeah, it's great. I love it, and it's endlessly fascinating.
Now, you kind of hinted there with the silent killer and the not just the Home Guard. So I'm going to have to ask you, it's like the core question of History Rage. Andy, what is the one thing you really wish people would just stop believing?
Yeah, so it is that. It is that thing that in the summer of 1940, that Britain was one, alone, two, weak, and three, basically sitting back and waiting for the inevitable invasion to happen. And the only thing that stopped it was Hitler's nervousness, the failure of Operation Sea Lion and the RAF. In fact, had the Germans managed to get across, there were whole layers of secret defence in place ready to take them on, to make sure that there wasn't a blitzkrieg as happened in the Low Countries and France. And what really winds me up is this almost pride that we have in this country, that we were just basically old men with pitchforks lining the cliffs, ready to take on panzers. And that pride has kind of built over the last 80 years, and things like Dad's Army, which I love and it's hilarious, has built on that perception of us being almost a bit of a joke and unorganized and a little bit pathetic.
Yeah, a little bit laughable.
Yeah.
A little bit bumbling. A little bit British.
A very, yes. The stereotypical British view of us in 1940 is essentially Corporal Jones.
Yeah.
That's what I say. Whereas the, you know, in my mind and the stuff that we research and find out about is actually by the end of 1940, there are like nearly 4,000 highly trained guerrilla saboteurs waiting in secret bunkers for the Germans to come across. There was a network of 3,000 highly trained civilian spies and wireless operators ready to pass on information about the invading army. And that's nothing to say about the bloody Royal Navy ready to come down and disrupt anything coming across. It's not to say anything about the RAF plan we've got in place exactly for this situation, which was then implemented pretty well. And you know, that there is nothing about Britain in 1940 that was weak and alone. We weren't alone. We got a whole bloody empire. We got thousands and thousands of men. We got, you know, it's just a weird pride we have in that. And you're right. It's that perception of Britishness, of sitting down, of having a cup of tea and just saying, well, if they come, they come. We'll sort something out. It'll be fine. But in fact, there was huge amounts of organisation, huge numbers of layers of highly secret defence being put in place, aside from pillboxes and stop lines and all the stuff that you see on the surface. It's just, I feel like we should have a new pride in the fact that we were strong, that we were prepared. And, you know, we had the opportunity to prepare because we had the channel in the way. Otherwise it could well have been another blitzkrieg. But we had the opportunity to prepare. We took that opportunity. And in fact, even before...
Go on, this is what the rage is all about.
Carry on, please do.
Even before the war had started, we had SIS and Section D going to Europe, going to countries almost surrounding Germany and talking to them about how they can set up some kind of resistance in advance. So we went to Czechoslovakia. Guys from SIS and military intelligence research were talking to the Skoda Works about how they could blow up their factories before the Germans got their hands on it. Unfortunately, it was all just a bit too late. Colonel Gubbins, who helped...
I love that name.
Gubbins is a great name, isn't it?
Yes.
Colin Gubbins, I mean, that's just such a good name. He extended the auxiliary units the length of the country. He was in Poland talking to the Polish government about setting up resistance forces as the Germans were entering. We knew the threat. And I think this also comes from appeasement and from Chamberlain and from this kind of lead up to the war, where there's this perception of us kind of just giving Hitler what he wanted. And to an extent, politically, that was happening. But underneath that, you know, the SIS and military intelligence research were all Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Nordics, talking to these countries about potential resistance forces. And when that turned out to be a bit too late because the Germans are already cracking on, it was just taken back to Britain. And we'd started that as well, with the home defence scheme with SIS and the auxiliary units with military intelligence research. So the whole point is, we weren't weak, we weren't alone, the invasion was never going to happen. But if it did happen, we weren't just sit there having a cup of tea and reading the Telegraph. We were going to be ruthless. And from a general perception of Britain that time, very un-British in terms of what we were going to carry out.
Yeah,
really, exactly right.
You know, we are Britain, bring it Hitler.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
So why do we, is this idea of like Dad's Army and Corporal Jones and Sergeant Wilson and being the entire Home Guard just so damn hard to shift? I mean, you can't move for like pride in the Battle of Britain, pride in the Hitler never got managed to invade, you know. Yeah. Just why can't we shift this from the British people?
Just for perspective, I was born like decades after Dad's Army finished airing, and I have posters and calendars and memorabilia from it in this room. That's how deeply ingrained Dad's Army is. Yeah, so why?
Yeah, yeah. And Dad's Army certainly didn't help in that. And it came at a time when, so I think after the war, Britain almost tried to, as the war was coming to an end, and just after the war, Britain was trying to portray this thing of us being on our own to try and persuade the US that we're not this great big empire and we weren't kind of land grabbing. I think there's an extent, and then Dad's Army came in the kind of late 60s, early 70s, just just to kind of carry on that momentum. But also there's this pride, you know, keep calm and carry on, which wasn't actually a poster that ever came out. But it's just stuff like that that keeps the momentum going of this pride we have in the fact that we were being very British about it. We were gathering golf clubs and pitchforks, and we were going to take the dastly Germans on at the, you know, as they came across, and we're going to
give these Jerrys what for?
Yeah, they don't like it up, and we're going to stick a pitchfork, you know, into a Panzer tank, and that's fine, and that's absolutely fine, and to an extent, in the very early days, for a couple of months, it was a bit like that, certainly with the LDV, but also, I feel like we should have more of a pride in the fact that it wasn't anything like that. And over 80 years, that this momentum of what Britain was like, one, as a country at that time, and two, how prepared we were going to be, has just continued generation after generation after generation. And even now when we speak to journalists. So I've just got I've just spoken to the Telegraph. We got a piece in the Telegraph the other day, and he wrote a nice piece on the special duties branch. But the headline and the main picture was still about Dad's Army.
Of course
it is, because one, that's an attention grabber, right? I'm a PR man by trade, right? I know that journalists use attention grabbing headlines. It doesn't necessarily have to be accurate, but it's what's going to draw the reader in and get them to read it. I understand that, but it's not accurate, but it adds to that momentum and portrayal of Britain this time. The other thing is that it's not, this period isn't extensively taught in schools, particularly. You kind of do the Munich crisis and then bits and pieces afterwards, but there isn't anyone necessarily telling future generations that wasn't the case, and they're kind of built up with what their parents are telling them, what their grandparents are telling them. It's just carrying on that momentum. So it just carries on no matter what. And that's, you know, what we're trying to do with CART is change that particular perception.
Just to clarify for listeners who don't know, SIS, that's Secret Intelligence Services, isn't it? What we call MI6, James Bond's sort of group.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Yeah. And Section D, they're kind of D for destruction, the forerunners of Special Operations Executive, the sort of sabotage and blowing things up and damaging the German war effort behind the enemy lines. Is that correct?
Yes. So I would say Section D. Yeah, close enough. Yeah. Section D was SIS. SOE was obviously military. And actually, there's lots of evidence of SIS kind of messing about with SOE stuff in France. Yeah. But very, very similar. So starting resistance forces in Europe. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just to clarify for listeners who don't know.
Can you tell us a bit about the people in the auxiliaries then, and, you know, who they are and what they're there to do?
Yeah. So again, this kind of goes against this isn't Dad's Army, right? So these are the auxiliary units were recruited the length of the country. So from Scotland down the east coast, southeast corner, south coast, southwest and south Wales. And the intelligence officers were sent out to find patrols of between 6 and 8 men in key areas where they could set up a patrol and do damage to the invading army. And the type of chaps they looked for were not Corporal Jones or Captain Mannerings. They were young, fit, mainly men in reserved occupations. So guys who would have otherwise have joined the armed forces but couldn't because they were farmers or miners or farm workers or estate workers or gamekeepers or whatever it might have been. So these guys are not Dad's Army. They are fit, they are strong, they are determined. They know their local area intimately, which is hugely important. They can travel across fields at night, and they're mainly, it's all on the coastal crush. So their role would have been, as the German invading army pushed into their towns, they would have disappeared. All these guys signed the Official Secrets Act. So their friends and family would have absolutely no idea where they have gone. And they would have disappeared to a secret disguised underground bunker where they would have sometimes literally have waited for the Germans to pass over the top of them and then come out at night and disrupted the supply chain. So this isn't about taking on the German army face to face. This isn't having a gunfight with them. This is about trying to stop the advance happening. This is also not the French resistance. This isn't a post-occupation long-term effort. This is basically a suicidal two-week effort. They had enough rations for 2 weeks, and that was their life expectancy. But they were to come out at night, and then they were to destroy the supply chain. So blow up bridges, blow up ammo dumps, blow up convoys, blow up parked trucks, blow up airfields, planes, blow up country houses that have been taken by the Germans as local HQs, and do anything that they can for a, you know, as they understood, a short period to slow down the advance, because the Blitzkrieg obviously flew through France and the Low Country, and it was the spearhead carrying on, but it was the supply chain following up that allowed that spearhead to continue. So anything that could disrupt that supply chain from helping the spearhead would want, you know, slow down the advance generally, but it would also give the regular army then time to, the British regular army, to time to take a step back, to gather themselves, and then to counterattack effectively. So this isn't about taking on the Germans in the streets. This is about a highly secret, highly trained civilian guys, and also, you know, trained killers to go and cause as much chaos as they could for as long a period as they could, but realistically, probably about 2 weeks.
So we're looking at loads of noise, loads of chaos, loads of disruption, loads of damaging everything that the Germans could possibly use within this country. And that's broadly the overall military objective. There's no end game here other than to eventually just be hunted down and killed.
Exactly right. So once the Germans were in their area, there is no communication from outside. So the guys, there's no phone, there's no orders coming in generally. So these guys were completely on their own. They'd already identified targets that they would take out immediately, both physical targets and human targets. But after that, then they would, you know, they'd have an observational post where they could keep an eye out on the potential targets. As they were coming back from destroying something, they'd also be the lookout for the next night's target. So, yeah, it's about causing as much as well. Anything that would pause the advance, anything that would make the Germans think, what the hell's going on here? We need to stop, get more supplies in because that's all been destroyed, but also find out what the hell's going on because we can't move on because all our ammo's gone, or our fuel's gone, or the train line's been blown up, whatever it might be. Anything that slows down that advance and gives our guys a chance to recover and counterattack. That's the aim.
Excellent. Well, I'll gather then, Carl, that you've got a question basically about pretty much the first order that comes in, yeah?
Yeah. So after the invasion happens, we keep hearing stories and reports that the auxiliaries were ordered to basically assassinate the people who had brought them in, people who knew who they were and what they were doing. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, we think so. Yeah, we do. Because if you think about it, as I said, they've got 2 weeks, right, to do as much damage as they can. Anything that has the potential to limit that time, they would get rid of immediately. So whether that is the guy, the policeman who had to go through their records to make sure they were okay to join the auxiliary units. He wouldn't have known they're joining the auxiliary units, but he would have seen their names together on a list. He would have to go because the Germans got hold of him. He might well have said that. The intelligence officer, the guy who went round to the counties to form these groups, obviously would have to have been taken out by someone because he knew where every patrol was, where every secret underground base was, potential targets. He knew everything.
Yeah.
And he'd have to be a type. He'd either have to kill himself or he would be assassinated. Anyone who accidentally discovered the operational base was a potential target. So whether that is an elderly couple in a house overlooking a bunker who occasionally saw the troops going in, the first guys this particular patrol in Cornwall would have to go and sort out was this elderly couple in the house.
Yeah.
We've got examples of young boys accidentally discovering the operational bases, these underground bunkers. There's a mix of whether they'd be on the list or actually they were forced to join the patrol. So yeah, absolutely, they would have to do that because it all of that has the potential to. They only had 2 weeks anyway, probably. So all of that has the potential to reduce the amount of time they could be effective. And that, again, goes against this whole thing that we have of Britain being lovely, lovely people, not being ruthless, just being, you know, playing cricket with a straight bat, everything like that. That's not what this is about. This is about utter ruthlessness. This is about having an objective, knowing that you've got a short amount of time to achieve that objective and getting rid of anything that might well have got in the way of achieving that objective. So this, again, goes against this whole thing that we have about Britain at this time and continues to wind me up because, I've spoken to these guys. And these guys weren't like psycho killers. I mean, they didn't want to do this stuff, but they saw the bigger picture and said, if we have to do it, then we have to do it because we knew that would, you know, that was our task.
Yeah, this all sounds incredibly brutal and ruthless, but it is the survival of Britain and countless other British lives that are at stake here. You don't want to kill this elderly couple or these kids who've just stumbled across your base, but you have to for the greater good.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as you say, it's essentially for Western democracy, right. Isn't it, really? Because if Britain had fallen, you know, that's a hell of a job for the states if they got involved to take on Germany without having some kind of, basically, we're an aircraft carrier to take the fight back to Germany. Without Western Europe, would be screwed. So yes, absolutely, it's brutal and it's horrible, but an elderly couple being killed that might, you know, stop an advance for a day, allowing our forces to recover and counterattack that might then lead on to other stuff, is in the auxiliary unit's minds, and rightly so, something that had to be done and was right to do.
It's interesting that you raise the point of, it's not Dad's army and we don't sit back. And so both myself and Kyle come from a kind of medieval background, and particularly I'm a longbowman, and it's like looking to medieval history, like Britain's never done chivalry. It's not been. We've always fought to win, and it does surprise me in warfare that we kind of still maintain this like stiff upper lip attitude that's just never really been around.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It is interesting that... You know, if you think how ruthless we were in the empire, and how ruthless we are on our own population, we were never. I think it's a really recent, certainly last 80 years of this perception of us being a lovely country playing with a straight bat. I don't think we've ever been like that particularly. We couldn't have empire grabbed had we done that. So it's just not the type of people that we were.
Yeah, just ask the Chartists or the protesters at Peterloo. That's how quick we're using to turn on each other, to be brutally, brutally honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly right.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Exactly right.
Okay. So in order to do all these fairly brutal, grisly activities, what kind of weapons are we talking here? I'm guessing this isn't farmers with shotguns and cobbled together Molotov cocktails. What are they actually using to achieve all this?
Yeah, and this is where it's really interesting, because at a time where admittedly a lot of our equipment had been left in Dunkirk and the LDV had been set up and had an amount of time where they were very short of weapons, were drilling with broomsticks and things like that. Actually, the auxiliary units were given priority on weapons. So they were the first units to get their hands on the Thompson submachine gun. And that's not just above the LDV Home Guard, that's above the regular army.
So we're not talking Stens here, are we? We're talking something that will work in the event of an invasion.
Yeah, they did have some Stens, but yeah, Thompson submachine guns they were given really powerful sniper rifles with .22s with telescopic aids. They were given each. So we've got a note from the archives. So Churchill was kept up to date with what was going on, and he'd scribbled on a note saying that all these men must have revolvers. So not just officers, but every single member of the auxiliary units was given a Smith & Wesson, something like that. Every single one. But I'm talking a lot about guns here, but actually the main weapons weren't guns. It was silent killing, because basically you don't want to get into a gunfight. These guns were there for emergencies, and the sniper rifle was there for living off the land or for getting rid of, you know, the people we've already talked about or German officers or collaborators. But their main weapons were silent weapons. So Fairbairn, Sykes, knives, knuckle dusters, like brutal stuff, because what you wanted to do was get the thing that you wanted to blow up. You didn't want to get into a massive fight. You wanted to just get rid of the sentry, if possible, leave his body in a mutilated fashion for his comrades to find, blow up the thing and get away without being caught. So you don't want to be firing a gun. What you want to be doing is using your knife or using a knuckle duster. And also, the other main weapons they had, which I've just referred to, is explosives coming out their ears. They had so many explosives. I've got like a in the 60s, a group commander in Essex still had the spares, right? This is the spare equipment that he had left over. He thought the army would come and collect it. It was never collected. And it was like thousands and thousands of pounds worth of explosives. His loft is like full of explosives and tripwires and like explosives made up, like time pencils made up. I mean, you know, and this is just spares. It's absolutely crazy. So they had it coming out of their ears. And this is because the relationship, Churchill, one, saw it as a priority, and two, GHQ saw it as a priority throughout. So they were given priority over weapons, and they were given priority over, I mean, explosives, like plastic explosives, the latest explosives they could get their hands off. And that's why people like miners were recruited in South Wales and the North East, because they obviously were used to blowing stuff up. So this was this was really effective. But yeah, they were given a whole range of weapons, stuff that the not only just the LDV and Home Guard were after, but the regular army as well. Such was their priority.
Yeah, it's a state-of-the-art military equipment. After they've got all these weapons and munitions and knives and whatnot, how did they learn how to use them? Where were they trained, and did they work alongside other units? Were they there with, say, the commandos or SOE agents, or did they go off and do their own sort of thing?
No, so they were completely isolated, really, because of the level of secrecy was so high.
Mm.
So and just going off topic slightly, even when they're, so to start with, they dug their own bunkers. Not usually very successfully, but eventually they brought in Royal Engineers and Canadians to come in and dig them for them. But they brought engineer groups from outside of the county to come and dig them, and then they'd go away again, just because they didn't want to be captured. But yeah, they trained in isolation. So they trained in two ways. One is that most counties had a group of auxiliary scout patrols. So these were regular soldiers, 6 to 7 men, who would have acted as a patrol themselves had the Germans invaded, but equally helped train the men locally in explosives and silent killing and stuff like that. The main headquarters and training centre is a place called Coleshill House, near in the hamlet of Coleshill, which is near Highworth Market Town, which is near Swindon. And this is where they did their training. So they were basically, and again, this talks to the level of one, organisation, and two, secrecy. One or two members of each patrol from the length of the country would be invited to get a train to Highworth, go to the local post office, where they would meet the postmistress, Mabel Stranks, by all accounts quite a miserable, angry character. You'd go in, give the password, you'd ask for 2 stamps, something like that, show your credentials, she'd go out the back, ring up Coleshill House, who'd then send around a truck to come and pick you up, and then drive a convoluted route back. So by the time you reach Coleshill House, you'd have absolutely no idea what you're there. But once you were there, you were trained in everything that you would need to know. So what, like how to dig an operational base, how to silent killing, how to navigate at night, how to move silently at night, how to blow up tanks, where to place the explosives on planes, everything that you would need to know. So whilst they didn't train with SOE operatives or the commandos, these guys were getting, certainly before SOE, I suspect, the training that these guys later had. It's that same level. And to the extent that some of the regular soldiers particularly, and actually some of the civilians as well, would later go on and join the SAS directly.
Wow.
Such was their level of training. And by then, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing. So their level of training was extraordinarily high. And again, this isn't straight cricket. This is dirty, dirty, mucky warfare, the likes of which you just wouldn't approach it.
This kind of leads me neatly into the next question, actually, because so once you've got all this training and everything like that, and let's assume the balloon goes up, the church bells start ringing, and etc. You know, what are the rules of engagement here? I mean, you say that there was nothing, no orders coming in. They're pretty much left to make it up as they go along. I mean, do they have boundaries? Are they military targets, transport targets, collaborating civilians? Are they fair game? What's the rules of engagement?
There are no rules of engagement.
They were.
I mean, there's a certain amount of trust here, and on these guys, and a certain amount of trust that they're not going to, I got asked a question the other day, were they likely to take out personal revenge against people they didn't like in their towns and villages? Well, I guess, yes, there is a potential for that. But actually, you have to trust these guys to make the right decision. So, yeah, there's no rules of engagement. Absolutely, collaborators were fair game. Because, again, they're helping the German army. If you get rid of them, and that means there's a gap between the Germans being able to get hold of something or knowing where something is, then absolutely fair game. There's patrols placed purposely. So there's patrol near me in Branscombe in East Devon that were very near two mother and son who were in the BUF and had visited and met Hitler in Germany in the 1930s and were very likely to be collaborators in the event of invasion. And they were placed there and you know, they were absolutely targets. And that's, you know, and it wouldn't have just been members of the BUF. It would have been anyone that was perhaps providing
aid and comfort to the enemy.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's anything that doesn't allow the Germans to have it their own way as they were perceived to have it in France and the Low Country.
Yeah, and you mentioned, we've talked a lot about these guys, actually, and anybody with an interest in wartime irregular forces just can't help but be falling over the women in SOE.
Yes.
You know, we use the word guys a lot. I mean, was there a role for women in the auxiliaries?
Not in the auxiliary units, no. But they were hugely involved and massively important in the special duties branch, which is kind of comes from the same place as the auxiliary unit. So a combination of SIS and Section D Home Defence Scheme stuff and then merged into military intelligence research, but actually were kept very separate from the auxiliary units. But these were civilian spies and wireless operators. So, and these weren't young, fit farmers. These were elderly people, vicars, doctors, vets, teenagers, anyone who could basically be standing on the street in a town or village as the Germans passed through. They would be trained in recognising formations and weapons and vehicles and direction of travel. They'd write it down and then send it on via dead letter drops and 20, 30 runners who would eventually end up with a civilian wireless operator who'd pass the information on to ATS girls in bunkers very similar to the ones that the auxiliary units were in, who would then be passing that information on to GHQ. So again, this is taking away the confusion that was the Blitzkrieg and giving GHQ and the armed forces the opportunity to make informed decisions about where to take on the enemy next. And the women in that played a huge role because it was women particularly basically could stay behind, as it were, without being suspicious. So if the German army passing through and they saw a 34-year-old farmer standing on the street looking at them, that's something that's probably going to grab their attention. If it's an elderly woman, if it's a publican, if it's a vicar, if it's a vet, if it's someone who they'd expect, they're not going to be suspicious of them. So women played a huge role in that in terms of civilians, but the ATS girls were hugely important. And you know, we've got examples of ATS girls committing suicides in their bunkers because they were spending weeks and weeks down there training. It's just a horrible environment. There's at least one girl who committed suicide down there. So you know, these are, and again, these girls got no recognition at all. When they were stood down in the summer of 1944, basically, they were so specifically trained, they couldn't go anywhere else in the ATS. They just left. There was no role for women within the specific operational auxiliary units, so the people who blew stuff up and silently killed, but were absolutely critical in that information gathering and wireless operation stage that would have played a hugely important role had the Germans come through.
Yeah, well, it's just mind-blowing stuff. And again, you just don't know that this network is sitting there kind of under our noses, their noses, and it's been here all along.
Yeah.
And it's a testament to the kind of security of the whole thing that we're only hearing about it over... I mean, I first heard about the auxiliaries, I think, about 15 years ago. And when there was a documentary called Churchill's Secret Army, which that being prior to that, even though I've been looking into the Second World War since I was 18, so for 30 years, it didn't even come up.
No, exactly. And it won't, because I think probably about 70% of those involved in both auxiliary units and special duties branch went to the grave without telling anyone, without telling wives.
Yeah.
You know, family members have no idea. We're still informing family members that that they were involved. And I'm speaking currently to a 104-year-old who now lives in Canada. And she was one of the runners for Special Duties Branch. And she's only just told her family. There's a guy in South Wales who about 7-8 years ago, we managed to get permission to march past the Cenotaph, which is a huge step because the Home Guard and Bevan Boys and all that and Land Army have been marched past for years. Anyway, there's a guy in Wales who only told his family that he was in the auxiliary units the day before the march because he needed a lift to London. So it's just, they kept it. There's a few reasons why. So one, both groups didn't think they'd done anything because neither were called upon, thankfully. So they just got on with their lives and carried on. Two, particularly the auxiliary units, were, as we've discussed, trained and asked potentially to take out members of their own community. And that's not a conversation you want to have post-war with people, potentially. So you just keep quiet about it.
Yeah, if you're going to settle down for a pint with the local copper, knowing full well you'd have blown his head off
exactly.
at the ring of the church bells,
exactly you would right. have... Exactly right. That's you know, I've said it before, that's awkward. That's an awkward conversation. Equally, they all sign the Official Secrets Act, and they're of that a generation that if they sign that Official Secrets Act, they're not going to change it. There's a guy who died fairly recently in Dorset, who we know absolutely 100% was in the auxiliary units because we've got his name. He still lived in the same house that he lived in during the war. He absolutely was in it, and not only did he not want to talk to us in any depth about his role, he categorically denied that he was in the auxiliary unit. He categorically denied it because we presumed because he signed the Official Secrets Act, didn't want to talk about it at all. Yeah. And that went for, as I said, I reckon about 70%. And the Special Duties Branch, we know we think there's about 3,500 people, civilians involved, probably a lot more if you think about it, because there was probably two or three observers per cell. There were then 20, 30 runners per cell, plus the wireless operators themselves. At minimum 3,500 civilians were involved, and we know less than 100, I would say, who have come forward and told us their stories. Less than 100, and they're all, you know, apart from this 104-year-old, all gone, as far as we know. And the Special Duties Branch particularly haven't left anything behind. They haven't got secret bunkers that we can go and find. They were just ordinary people, and that's the most fascinating thing about this. The Special Duties Branch particularly, they aren't even of army age. They aren't. These are just normal civilians who were carrying on with their daily life, as the Yorkshire units were. But these guys, you know, vicars who had radio sets in their altars, publicans who, you know, had wireless sets in their lofts. They didn't say anything, and everything was taken. All their wireless sets and everything were taken behind. So there's nothing remaining about them that's tangible almost. At least with the auxiliary units, we have these amazingly disguised operational bases. But with the Special Duties Branch, there's nothing tangible left, which is a real, real shame, because they got absolutely zero public recognition. And again, they were, you know, either signed Official Secrets Act or sworn to secrecy, and they absolutely knew the risk. If you were caught observing the German army as they passed through, or if you were caught as a runner with a secret message, or if you were more likely caught with a wireless set, and if you think about it, this isn't like SOE where you're able to shift your wireless set around every now and then. You were in a set location with your wireless set, and you were likely to be caught very, very quickly. And if each runner didn't know who the other runner was in the sequence, if one of those runners was pulled out, then the whole system would collapse immediately. And they all knew this. They all knew the risk they were taking. So they were, you know, again, it's essentially a suicide mission, but they got zero recognition. And that is why, you know, this perception of Britain as a pitchforks and not really prepared has carried on with this momentum, because people just don't know. And people, I feel like, you know, how, if you're sitting there as an auxiliary unit member or as a Special Duties Branch and you're reading something or you're watching Dad's Army about this, you know, buffoons, hilarious as it is, I mean, I'd feel I'd be in internal turmoil. Must have been crazy, because it's just, you just want to scream. It's not, you know, it wasn't like that.
So you've kind of touched on this in a few other comments, but how did these people basically feel about this? These are highly trained, highly motivated people who were prepared to lay down their lives in the thick of fighting the enemy. But they're left behind in England. I mean, there's fighting in, say, Greece and North Africa and Italy. You mentioned they were stood down in 1944. There's an awful lot of war going on between the threat of invasion and 44. How do they feel about being left out?
Yeah, well, I think as the war went on, as I said, some went into special forces. Others, as the threat of invasion diminished, were called up in kind of 43, 44 and went into various units. So some did, but as I said, most of them were in reserved occupations, and I guess they kind of felt like most people did in reserved occupations. I guess there was a certain amount of frustration. But if you're a farmer, for example, you're working your ass off because you know that, you know, you're doing more farming than you've ever done before, because the country is absolutely is absolutely in need of food from our shores. So I feel like there was a frustration, but I think also they also had a pride that they were highly trained, and you know, also had this little secret. I mean, they can, you know, lots of wives, we've spoken to over the years thought their husbands were having affairs and they got white feathers and all this terrible stuff. But actually, I think there's a combination of frustration that they couldn't join up and go and do stuff. But equally, you know, they had a certain pride that they, you know, that they knew that what they were prepared to do in the event of an invasion. And the guys that we've spoken to over the years certainly had that. That they, you know, they were modest guys, but also they had still had that kind of grim determination to say, you know, if the balloon had gone up, we'd absolutely have done our job across the board. And I think there is a combination of things. It's probably a very confusing time for a lot of them. But yeah, so some got called up, but most of them were reserved miners or farmers and things. So they just got on with their day jobs, and that's exactly the same as when they were stood down and the auxiliary units in November 1944. They just got on with it. They just carried on farming.
Yeah,
they just shut up their operational bases.
So the campaign's on for more recognition for these people. How would people listening to this podcast get involved with that campaign?
Yeah, so it'll be, I mean, if you visit our website, staybehinds.com, you can, one, learn a lot more about these guys and what they got up to. But equally, you know, anything to spread the word and to get more information. I think that's the most important thing from our perspective is to really try and find out as much as we can about these guys, to find out the location of their operational bases, which we still many that we still don't have a clue where they are, and they could be, you know, fully intact. Just anyone that has any information, because it's so secret, we often have to go off like village gossip and rumours and stuff like that. So, you know, any rumours of sometimes they describe themselves as like a ultimate home guard or a, you know, SAS home guard style units, or rumours. There's a rumour at a village near me that I did a talk the other day and about the special duties branch, and this guy came up to me and said, "Oh, you're probably talking about the spies in the Molster's Arms, were you?" So after the war, there was a rumour going around that there were spies in the Molster's Arms. We know absolutely there was a civilian wireless set in that tiny village, so it's more than likely that these guys, the publican, was a special duty branch operator. So that's the kind of stuff we go for. So anyone with any information like that would be great to hear from. But yeah, check out the site, have a look around. I've got a book coming out next year. Buy that. but yeah,
oh, we'll get you back on for next year for the
so the book. That'll be because I'm going deeper than special duties branch and auxiliary units. There are even more secret layers of resistance, post-occupation resistance rather than invasion. So I'm doing auxiliary units, special duties, but then there's like Section 7, there's urban industrial saboteurs, there's home guard shock squads, lots of really fascinating stuff.
So, yeah. We would love to get you back on next year to find out what's pissed you off when researching all that.
Absolutely. Love to.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. I mean, that was fascinating. It was brutal. It was dark. it was breathtaking.
Good. No, I'm glad you enjoyed.
Well, you can learn more about the fascinating work of the Coleshill Auxiliary Research Team and work through the British Resistance Archive at their website, as Andy says, www.staybehinds.com. Or you can follow him on Twitter @chats1. And we'll have links for those in the show notes. What can I say, Andy? Thank you very much for coming on. That has been stunning.
No, it was an absolute pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can follow us on Twitter. I am @PaulBavel.
And I'm @KyleGHistory.
And you can leave comments, thoughts, and please send your own history rages using the #HistoryRage. If you've enjoyed our work, then please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, Google, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.